Coming up on This Week in Broadway, we talk with Stephen Flaherty. We also talk about the openings of Magic Bird and Evita, as well as a few other shows, so come join us. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 15th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer. You could see his writing at the New York Star Ledger. He also writes for Kritzerland on Friday. He also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You could see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could see his photography at FileSpotPhoto.com. Michael writes for other venues such as Arts America and the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have Stephen Flaherty. You might know Stephen. He is the composer of Broadway musicals such as Ragtime, Seussical, and Once on This Island. He's also contributed the music to Cheetah Rivera, The Dancer's Life. And he's also written four musicals that were produced at Lincoln Center, The Glorious Runs, Dessa Rose, A Man of No Importance, and My Favorite Year, which is my favorite show. His other theater scores include Lucky Stiff and Loving Repeating, a musical of Gertrude Stein. Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's great to be here. Thanks.
All righty. So you are very busy these days. You have a production of Once on This Island opening up a paper mill very soon, and also a New York Pops concert on Monday, the 30th of April at Carnegie Hall. How are you juggling all this?
Well, precariously, but it's a great year. It's a really exciting time, and the Pops tribute sort of came out of the blue. We were actually in the studio recording the soundtrack for a film version of Lucky Stiff that's actually being filmed this summer with Christopher Ashley, and I had this message come in, and it was like, we'd like to honor you at Carnegie Hall on April 30th. And actually, Lynn and I were teaching that night at the Dramatists Guild, and I said, I think this trumps teaching.
Yeah.
So we're delighted. It's with this wonderful orchestra conducted by Stephen Reinecke, and we've invited a lot of our friends, people who have starred in our various shows over the years, and also some new people that we've not worked with before. So we're really looking forward to it. And we're premiering some new orchestrations, and actually we have a new song that we're going to play for the first time.
That's great. I didn't mention in the opening that you have film credits that include Anastasia, Bartok the Magnificent, and you also worked on the documentary After the Storm. So to add Lucky Stiff into that is...
The funny thing about Lucky Stiff is that we had done it. It was actually Lynn's and my first produced show here in New York. And we did it in 1988 at Playwrights Horizons. And our orchestra, if you can call it that, we're just four players. You know, it's just a piano, keyboard, bass, and drums. And now to bring it to the screen, we have these amazing and amazingly beautiful orchestrations by Michael Starobin, for a complete orchestra of 35. So to go from 4 to 35 is, it's like your dream. All of a sudden everything is Technicolor. So actually using some of those orchestrations at the Pops, so they've never been heard.
Wow.
So doing a couple of things from Lucky Stiff that night.
All right. Movies are notorious for dropping wonderful songs from musicals. Are you going to have to lose any?
From the new pieces? Well, we're not doing any dropped songs, but I think I'm...
No. What I mean is the movie version of Lucky Stiff. Will we lose some songs that we know and love from Lucky Stiff?
Well, I think we have 13 in the film, which is actually a lot, quite a lot. But we've lost a couple that we and the director thought might be better served, as action sequences. So there are a few lost, but we have a new song that we've written for it.
Lucky Stiff have a big car chase now?
Giant car chase in 3D. That's right.
Excellent.
Steven,
do you actually recall what songs have been lost?
While they were driving those cars.
Do you actually recall what songs have been lost?
For the movie? Well, I do. But shall I tell you? a couple of things from Act 2, because Act 2 obviously starts speeding up. And as the action speeds up, you lose a couple. But I think all of the greatest hits are certainly there, and we have a totally charming new song that starts the picture. So.
Michael,
Steven, this is the first. This is the first I've heard of it. Excuse my ignorance. That's great.
Well, it's been sort of like low on the radar. We're actually just finishing casting it, so we almost have our complete cast. But our Harry Witherspoon is a wonderful young British actor by the name of Dominic Marsh. And Dominic was just in the Umbrellas of Cherbourg over on the West End, and he's absolutely, absolutely charming, and sings like a bird, and he's totally, totally an amazing, unassuming leading man. Yeah, so we were absolutely thrilled whenever he popped through the door.
Stephen, you had mentioned that you were teaching at the Dramatists Guild on the same night at the Carnegie Hall thing. Teaching and giving back to the community seems to be a very large part of what you and Lynn do all the time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I came to New York City in the fall of 1982, and I kept thinking that what would be ideal is if there were some sort of a mentorship program, where you could, learn from, an old master, even a middle-aged master, and you could learn your craft. And that wouldn't be like necessarily an academic, program. And nothing really existed like that at the time. And so I had met Lynn in the BMI workshop, and we had done the BMI program as well as the ASCAP program and, other songwriting programs, but there wasn't anything really that was like a mentorship or an observership. So about 10 years ago, we overhauled the Dramatists Guild Fellows Program, and Lynn and I co-chair the musical theater portion of that. And the thing that's really great is it combines playwrights with musical theater people, so everybody is in the same room together, learning together. And in the past, in other programs, they tend to ghettoize, the playwrights and the musical theater people, not realizing that, in fact, we're all, storytellers, dramatic storytellers, but the music theater people, use music. So this program is Lynn and myself and Susan Miller and Andrea Lepsio and Janet Nypris. And we meet several times a month, and there's a mentorship component to it, and there's an observership. And actually, one of the most amazing observerships we ever had and mentorships is one of our songwriting teams came with Lynn and I to Boston for the out-of-town tryout of Seussical, which was, a famous disaster, in 2000. And those young people, I think, learned more from seeing things not going well and, how we dealt with very difficult circumstances, than if the show had gone really smoothly. So the idea is it's to share the good, the bad, and the ugly, with the emerging writers.
But ho, 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 who has the last laugh now? Seussical, I see it all the time. I'm about to see another production at Amas. Does it actually get done in regional theater more than Ragtime does?
It's our number one show.
Isn't that something?
For several years, it was actually the number one most performed show in America. I think we were the number one musical, and Midsummer Night's Dream was the number one play. So,
Did you see it coming? Did you say when it closed, we are going to be redeemed? The day will come when this is appreciated?
Well, you know, I mean, you had spoken a little bit about songs that get cut by the wayside, you know, in the course of writing shows. And for every opening night, I give Lynn a book, and I bind the book. And it's basically all of the songs that never made it into the show. And I categorize them like songs that never left your living room, songs that never made it past the first reading. and it's sort of a place where, you know, the lost songs live, you know, where they can sort of keep one another company. And for Seussical, it's the only show that on the opening night of Broadway, I didn't give her a book because I thought this is unfinished business. You know, this show is not finished and we're opening and, you know, to be continued. And so that's sort of what it was. You know, we did some rewrites for the first national tour, which was directed by Christopher Ashley. So then we went back and then we did a one act version, which ultimately came back to the Lortel Theater here in New York City. And that's maybe my favorite version.
I saw that one.
Yeah, it was really good.
Really fun.
Yeah.
Christopher Ashley keeps popping up into your life there.
He's a funny guy, and he understands the rhythm of comedy. And we actually hadn't worked with him since that tour of Seussical. But then when we were talking about this film version of Lucky Stiff, we thought, you know, who knows the film medium? And he had actually done a wonderful indie film of Jeffrey, you know, the play Jeffrey,
sure.
which I thought was totally charming. Mm-hmm. And this was on the budget of indie film. You know, this is not like a lavish Hollywood musical, although we have wonderful orchestrations and the musical values are incredible. So we thought Chris would be kind of perfect for it. And he's a great collaborator and hilariously funny.
All right. Now, where's the new song going? What is it?
Well, it's happening right in the opening credits, and it's called Lucky Stiff. And there's something that's kind of really wild. Going back to 1988, when we had written the show and trying to get into your head, you know, where you were in 1988, and it was sort of a mind bender, you know, at first, you know, but it's a totally a charming song, and Lynn has done the screenplay for the film. And she came up with a really, really funny opening sequence that sort of introduces the characters and in an unexpected way. That's all I'm going to say.
Next. Okay.
Yeah.
How about Rocky?
Rocky is going great. That's actually the next show up on the boards. We're premiering in Hamburg, which maybe is the definition of way out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we premiere this fall in Hamburg, and really the first thing up is we're finishing our casting next month, and then we're working on a German language cast album. So actually the German language cast album will precede the American cast album, and we're doing that in August.
Will Hasselhoff be in it?
Oh, I hope not.
He's an honest man.
I hope not. No, he's very popular over there, Andy.
He is.
it's funny, though, but out of our shows, Lucky Stiff is a huge cult hit over in Germany. They love it. So, and oddly enough, the translator of Lucky Stiff in German is actually doing the song translation of Rocky. A wonderful lyricist in his own right, Wolfgang Aidenberg.
Stephen, you mentioned the new song that's going to be heard at Carnegie Hall in the Pops concert. Is that a standalone song, or is it from something?
It's from a new project. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay,
it's from a new project, but it's never been heard in public before, nor has it been orchestrated. So we have a new orchestration, and I'm also playing a song that is a standalone song. I'm playing for Rebecca Luker. And it's a song that I think a lot of people don't know, so I'm excited about that. Well, and also, honestly, the thing I'm most excited about is my mother is going to be in the audience. She's never been to Carnegie Hall.
Well, you know, I was there just the other night for the Pops. They're doing a lot of concerts lately. In fact,
they did two in a row, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, I think yesterday they did another two of with a concert with the Muppets.
I know, isn't that great? Muppets are hot this year. They're really hot. Yeah.
But the other night they played movie music, Gone with the Wind, Adventures of Robin Hood, Star Wars. It was unbelievable. It's just so amazing to hear that, you know, it was like 80 people, 80 players.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I'm really, really excited about, you know, because we all know that in this day and age that Broadway pits just shrink, and they keep getting smaller and smaller. So to hear something played that gloriously with that amount of detail by, you know, a huge symphony orchestra, it's just thrilling.
Thrilling.
The Addams Family is doing does promo videos that they throw up on YouTube about backstage tours, and they interviewed what they called the interview with the orchestra, and they interviewed three people. And I was afraid of that because there's got to be more than three people in that orchestra, right?
Oh, I would hope so.
Stephen, I know you need to get out into your Sunday morning, but before you go, I wanted to just talk briefly about what's happening up at Paper Mill with this production of Once on This Island. Tell us a little bit about that.
Are going to be made?
Yeah, it's really, really exciting. This is a new production of Once on This Island. And we've seen so many different versions of that particular show since it debuted in 1990. And one of the things that we've noticed is it's been performed in a multicultural way over the years. And that's something that we're really excited about. So it's a multicultural cast. And we're playing with the score. We're not adding new songs or cutting measures, but we're adding more of a multicultural feel to the orchestration. So I'm collaborating with our music director and orchestrator, Lynn Schenkel, and we're adding a lot more influences. So there's more of a South American influence, there's more of a Cuban influence. We have two killer percussionists and two guitars, and it's an interesting thing. When we did it on Broadway, we actually only had five in the pit. People find that hard to believe, but we only had five players. So it's slightly expanded for Paper Mill. So it's really fun. It's been great to revisit that show, and the cast is amazing, I have to say. And our director is Thomas Kale, who did In the Heights.
Yes.
And he has a lot of really fun ideas. So we're having a grand time.
That's great.
Oh, and I have to do one more plug for the people that are going to be in London this summer. Ragtime is going to be at Regent's Park all summer.
Yes.
So I'm really excited about that. And again, it's a new orchestration by Chris Walker. And they begin previews, I believe, May 18th. And then we run into September. So they're during the Olympics. So I mean, I'm really excited about that, too. And the director is Tim Sheeter, who's doing the Into the Woods that's going to be at the Delacorte this summer.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So tell me, am I remembering this correctly, that Once on This Island was originally started at BMI?
Yeah, that's actually correct. You know, it's an interesting thing. Our first show, Lucky Stiff, we presented virtually all of the songs from Lucky Stiff at both ASCAP and BMI. And then we started work on Once on This Island, which was wildly different from Lucky Stiff. You know, world music, it was a much more emotional show. It sort of had its own rules. And we started presenting songs from Once on This Island at BMI. And oddly, the critique was where they had just left off with Lucky Stiff, where they would say, oh, this song isn't quite as witty as your last lyric, or this, you know, and I said to Lynn, they don't understand what the show is.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually sort of formed a little expat group during that period, because I did want feedback, you know, from peers, but that show didn't seem to work in that particular workshop. So I sort of made a little exit.
How long have you known Lynn, and how did you guys get together?
Well, Lynn and I actually met the very first month that I moved to New York City. I moved right directly from college. I had gone to Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music and studied composition there. So I came in the fall of 82, and we met at the BMI workshop. And at the time, I had been writing both lyrics and music myself. And Lynn in the past had written music as well as lyrics. So we both met at that time, and within 6 months, we wound up working together. Because I had never really collaborated, which was an interesting thing. You know, I was sort of my own, sort of left to my own devices by default kind of guy. And I really admired what she did. And in the beginning, our working methods were so radically different. So it actually took a while for us to get, you know, on the same beam. But I really, really admired what she did. And it proved to be a good fit. So actually, this year is our 29th year of working together.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a while, yeah.
Great. Well, let me let you get on to your Sunday morning. We thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's totally my pleasure. And for people that are in the New York City area, come out to Carnegie Hall on April 30th, Monday evening, and we promise a terrific show.
We really should mention the cast because it's amazing.
Oh, do you have the list, or shall I like give?
Would you?
Yeah, it's wonderful. We have a lot of people that have originated roles for us. So we have Maren Mazey, LaShans, Keisha Lewis Evans, Rachel York, Rebecca Luker, Jason Danieli, Norm Lewis is singing for us, and we actually gave Norm one of his early jobs. He was our understudy on the First National of Once on This Island.
Huh. Wow.
And my mother has been carrying a torch for Norman decades now, so she's very excited that he will be singing on the program. And then a lot of newer people that we've not worked with. We have a Nikki James, who's delightful, and Andrew Reynolds, and we have Boyd Gaines and Tyra Peck. And so it's quite a group.
I don't remember, Stephen. Has Norm ever played Cole House?
He has in regional productions. He was actually poised to overtake. Ooh, that's not the word.
Take over.
To take over, yeah, from Brian Stokes Mitchell on Broadway. But that was the season where there was that campaign, like sideshows coming back. So, you know, he had obviously originated a wonderful role in that show, and so he chose not to take over the role. But it's amazing, and I just think he's so spectacular in Porgy and Bess. So I'm delighted that he's going to be singing for us on his one night off too.
No, excellent.
Okay, well, thanks, fellas. It was a great way to start the morning.
All right, want to thank Stephen for getting up on a Sunday morning and speaking with us, and that was very interesting to find out about a Lucky Stiff. We didn't have any idea that there was a movie of it happening, but. Looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. So, next on the agenda, we had a few Broadway openings this week. Magic Bird opened. And, Michael, why don't you start us with Magic Bird?
I enjoyed it very much. Not as much as Lombardi, which was a show, a play that was put together by the same creative team, the same writer, Eric Simonson, and director Thomas Kail, and producers. Fran Kermser and Tony Ponturo. I think because the story of Magic Bird to me is inherently less dramatic. As I suspected, very wisely, Simonson tries to sort of peg it on the main dramatic fodder being the fact that, of course, Magic Johnson turned out to have AIDS, or actually the HIV virus, I should say. He never has developed full-blown AIDS, fortunately. And that, as anyone remembers from that time, was just an amazing, very singular event in history, because he put a whole new face on the disease, as it was said, because of, you know, he was such a beloved figure, and people had it, some people had it in their minds that AIDS, only certain types of people got AIDS, and only gay people, and blah, blah, blah. So that was really an amazing thing that happened. And actually, Magic Bird opens with sort of at that point where that incredible news came out, and then it kind of flashes back to the early the start of the career of both Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and then it moves forward again to the and it shows how they were really kind of bitter rivals in a sense for much of their careers, but then they became friends. And I think I always think that's a very fascinating phenomenon. I was reminded of how we have heard that Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford became very, very close friends after their respective presidencies, even though they were obviously bitter rivals and on opposing teams. And I remember seeing them, the two of them interviewed, and someone said to them, well, you know, how could you, but, you know, you said such strong things against each other when you, you know, when you were on opposing teams, and they sort of laughed and said, oh, you know, well, we just had to do that. It's all politics. So I'm always fascinated by the fact that, you know, people who can be ideologically so different or against each other publicly, but really respect and, you know, and like and love each other, privately. So I think that's what makes Magic Bird very interesting to watch. But the problem is that aside from the HIV thing, it's not an inherently dramatic story. The only other thing in it that's really kind of interesting, and I didn't know because I'm not really a sports fan, was that I guess Larry Bird had some major back problems at one point in his career, and that kind of ramps things up also. But other than that, it's kind of a pretty standard issue story. They also, it's interesting, there's an inherent problem in dramatizing this particular story because apparently Larry Bird was and presumably is a very taciturn, very kind of silent type of person, a person of very few words, not voluble at all. That's how he's portrayed here. And actually, it's kind of used for comedy, I would say, to a certain extent, the way that he tends to give one-word answers to questions and be very kind of like, yep, nope, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, as I say, they do try to use it in the drama, but it does it becomes a little difficult when one of your two major characters is like that. But having said that, I thought they did a very good job. The two major roles are played by Kevin Daniels as Magic Johnson and Tug Coker as Larry Bird. And Peter Scolari, I must single out, does really excellent work in a variety of other roles, including the coaches of both opposing teams. so he really gets to work at it. And I love to see him on stage. I'm not sure why his career hasn't been a little more stellar than it has, because I think he's a very, very talented person. I recommend the play, and I happen to be in the vicinity on opening night, and I know that both Magic Johnson and Larry Bird attended, so that that must have been quite a night for everyone involved, I would imagine.
Oh, I don't know about everyone, Michael. I'd hate to be the people sitting behind them.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Peter, what did you think there?
I certainly saw Larry Bird and Magic Johnson play, though never against each other. I saw them in their various home arenas, the Boston Garden and the Forum in Los Angeles. So I thought that the two guys were pretty good in replicating who these guys were, certainly based on all the TV interviews that I had seen over the years. So, Michael's right about the fact that, or at least let's say I agree with Michael, they made the best they could out of the situation that Larry Bird is, as Michael says, a man of few words. Maybe a thesaurus would help. Who knows? Once the situation was set up that these two guys were on opposite teams, but they really had the propensity to like each other, I don't know what else can really much happen with that. So it was a perfectly acceptable afternoon that I had. It started, it continued, it ended. I went home. One of those things that you give 2.5 stars, 2 out of 4. You know, it's quintessentially the perfect, ideal 2.5 stars out of 4 type of event. It's never terrible. One of the things that's very interesting is that you get a situation where Larry Bird is about to take a shot at a basketball hoop, and I thought, whoa, this is dangerous. I mean, he's supposed to be this great star. star, you know, and here's this actor who better make this shot. And then they prepare for that. What they do is they bring in film and they show the actual Larry Bird making the shot. So you don't have the poor actor with that strife. Nevertheless, this is live theater. And just as State Fair, the musical suffered because it involves ring tossing, that a guy's supposed to, Wayne, the son, has practiced for a year ring tossing so that he can win prizes at the State Fair. And they had him throw the rings off stage, you know, so that he might not be humiliated if he missed them. You know, and just as in Big, the musical Big, when they played the piano, the enormous piano, when they danced on the keys, the orchestra played the note as opposed to they played the note. So there's always something bad about that when you have to do some artificial means to cover, because this is live theater and you want to see it actually done. So, but you know, one can really understand that it would be too much. You know, anybody who knows basketball knows how many times that players taking foul shots, simply standing there with nobody bothering them, and all they have to do is throw the ball up and get in the basket. It looks like for a pro, it would be no problem at all. But indeed, it is a problem many of the times. Plenty of people, in fact, plenty of very good basketball players have been terrible foul shooters. So I guess it is too much to ask for to have that happen. I'm surprised they never told us how Irvin, as is his real name, became known as Magic. That isn't brought up at all in the play, and I wish that it had been. I wish that something had been made of the fact that Larry Bird's number was 33 and Magic Johnson's number was 32. I would think that that would come up somewhere, you know, the fact that is the implication that Larry Bird's a little better? I mean, I would think that would be worth a line of dialogue. So I have to say that I didn't like the way Brian Gumbel was portrayed. I'm no fan of Gumbel, but nevertheless, the actor who was asked to play him, Francois Batiste, was asked to give a very high falsetto-type voice, and it's not the way Brian Gumbel sounds at all, and I thought it was a type of cheap shot there that wasn't needed. As far as Peter Scolari is concerned, I like him too, though I will say that his performance in the TV version of Stop the World, I Want to Get Off was really horrific. Where he played Little Chap, and it turned out to be Little Chap of Horrors. But the thing is, Peter Scolari does do a good job in terms of playing so many other characters, but I've certainly seen Pat Riley, the coach of the Lakers, a number of times, and Red Auerbach, certainly, you know, having grown up in Boston as I did, and I saw no basis in reality for either one of those impersonations, but he is good in the other parts. And let's also say that one of the nice surprises of the play is Deirdre O'Connell playing Larry Bird's mother. And when Magic Johnson comes over to dinner, she's much more impressed with Magic Johnson and really implies that he's the better ball player. So that's kind of interesting. That's the biggest surprise of the night for me, you know, having a mother fawn over the other player and neglect her son, who does not take it in good humor either. So for me, that was the best part of Magic Bird. I don't see this play lasting long on Broadway. I agree with Michael that Lombardi seems to be the better of the two properties, and that had a tough time of it too. Yeah. So how will this do? I guess it's nice that they're trying to bring sports themes plays to Broadway, but I can't imagine they're going to meet with much success. Certainly already we know about Lombardi that it didn't, but I don't predict much more for this one. I guess they're hoping for Tony nominations to spur them on, isn't everybody, but I don't think there's going to be much happening with the Tonys.
We should mention, though, Peter, that because you alluded to it, there is some, very little, but there is some actual basket shooting in the show. Tug Coker does it as Larry Bird. I don't think that the other actor did it. But it's very, you know, it's like he's like right under the basket.
Well, it's also that's supposed to be practice. But I mean, there is a situation where you're supposed to be in a game. And this is going to be the dramatic shot. And that's where the film takes over. You know, yeah, practice. That's nothing, you know, because he's also talking and he's distracted, you know.
Right.
You know, so if he makes it, it's fine. If he doesn't, that's all right, too.
Oh, yeah. That's
but,
a good point.
But when the chips are down, the film takes. So let's go to the film, to paraphrase Warner Wolf.
I thought that this was interesting that the producers have gotten the league involved. The NBA is seems to be very active within the Broadway production, as the NFL was very active within the Lombardi production. Yeah. And I think that you have much more of an opportunity to get lots of different celebrities and teams and sports figures in to see this show versus Lombardi, because with the schedule of the NBA having so many more games than the NFL having games, and especially being here in New York, it's possible that they're going to be able to market this a little bit, have a little bit easier time marketing this than they had with the other one, with Lombardi. But it's certainly out of the box producing, and we'll have to see where it goes. But do you think that they'll be able to tour this?
God, no. I just don't see any economic future for this whatsoever. Would they be able to? Yeah, I mean, it's not an expensive show, Lord knows. But nevertheless, I just can't imagine people being very interested. Hmm. It is. Yeah, maybe in Boston, maybe in Los Angeles. It's funny that it's in New York when you think of it. Though I guess that's true of Lombardi, too. Yeah, he was with the Giants for a while, but his persona certainly was with the Packers, and to a lesser degree, the Redskins. But Packers is really where the power was, the Green Bay Packers. So maybe this will get a production at Speakeasy in Boston, or at the Celebration in Los Angeles. I guess there'd be more interest there.
Peter, about 2 years ago, we talked about on this podcast a show about the Boston Red Sox. I can't remember the name of it, but we thought it was a terrible name to play in New York. And I wondered if it ever came in off Broadway. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Not offhand, though. What immediately comes to mind is Damn Yankees was rewritten with the Red Sox in mind. Joe DiPietro did instead of the Washington Senators was the Red Sox. And maybe that's what you're talking about. And it struck me as something that really wouldn't fly terribly well in New York.
Something about integration.
All set. Johnny Baseball.
Johnny Baseball, yes. That's what it was.
Terrific show, but again, because it dealt with the Red Sox and exclusively the Red Sox. That's right.
The subtitle Beyond Johnny Baseball had something to do with the Red Sox, and I was like, oh, that's never going to play in New York.
Well, yes, especially with the 2004 season, where the Red Sox came back after being down 3-0 to the Yankees and won 4 straight. So that's specifically the time frame of this show. So yeah, good for you, Johnny Baseball. Terrific musical, though. I don't know that it's surfaced anywhere else.
Yeah. All right. Next on our agenda, we're going to talk about the opening of Evita. So, Peter, why don't you get us started on Evita?
I liked it quite a bit. What I liked most about it, frankly, was that it didn't have very much in common with the Harold Prince production back in the late 70s. Nothing against the Prince production. Fabulous. Saw it many times. Loved it. It's just I was up for something new. And certainly this director gave me that. And that's what I appreciated more than anything else. I love the fact that we had genuine sets here. They're not magnificent sets. They're meant to replicate the Casa Rosada. They almost look like they'd be right for a musical version of A Night at the Museum. That's what they really look like. The inside of a museum, and they're towering. They don't do much. There's not much to them in the sense of the next scene takes place in a very different. No, you're always there in with those looming sets in the background, but still, to me, this was a nice departure from the famous elevated balcony catwalk that Harold Prince used, and which we've seen a lot of, especially from Des Makhanov. So it was nice not to see that. So I like that. And I like that the staging bore no resemblance to what Prince did. Again, Prince was marvelous. That revolving door when Evita was getting rid of her men, going through men like we used to go through TV guides one a week. That was great. You know, I mean, but nevertheless, I was up for seeing something different, and this director gave it to me at every time. I would say that only about 2% of the blocking really ever resembled the Prince production, so I like that very much. Ricky Martin, he feels his lyrics, but I have to say, I don't think this guy knows what to do with his hands. Very uncomfortable, very stiff. gestures were really of a high school level. Elena Roger, yes, the stuff we've heard in advance about the fact that her voice isn't quite as good as we had hoped turned out to be true, especially in that very difficult section of A New Argentina, where she has to go really high. She finessed that and took it half tone lower on certain notes. So that was a bit of a disappointment. She's very short, but suddenly I started thinking, you know, Patti LuPone's not a tall woman. Have you ever stood next to Patti LuPone? She's very diminutive, and yet she didn't seem it on stage, did she? This lady seems diminutive. You know, it's funny because there's a lyric about the actress hasn't learned her lines. This actress has learned her lines. I understand she's learned them phonetically, and sometimes that's apparent to me. I don't even know if that's true. I have heard that. But there were scenes when I thought that was really true. For example, the difficult scene where Perón is discussing her dying, she had this smile on that I thought was completely inappropriate. I guess she should know by now exactly what she's doing and what's happening in the show. So, I mean, I may be overestimating or underestimating her in understanding what's going on. But nevertheless, Michael Cera was very good. Very good indeed, playing Perón, is keeping his cards close to the vest and not letting us know too much about him. I am in heaven during the second act of Evita for the first like five or six numbers, which I think are spectacular. After Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, High Flying Adored, Rainbow High, and The Money Keeps Rolling In. It's just so great. You know, it reminded me too of when I first saw Once of the Silence, to harken back to Stephen, when one song came after another, and I couldn't believe how good each successive song was. And so it was, I really love when the second act of Evita starts, that I know I'm in for a real treat with all those songs coming one after the other. So I will say the one thing the director did that I didn't like at all was he dropped the opening section where we're at a movie theater, and at the movie theater they get the news that Evita has died. Now what happens here is you hear the announcement, but the curtain is still down, and the curtain goes up on the funeral, and everybody's very sad. Okay, fine, but people act sad at a funeral whether they're sad or not. By having us see the people at the movie theater when the announcement is made and see them go, oh, no, oh, this is terrible, and go into mourning immediately, you know that they really loved Evita. Here you can't be sure of that because, again, as I say, people behave well at a funeral. You know, so I missed that drama at the beginning, and I worried for the show. So I thought that was a mistake. But aside from that, I thought this was a very good revival, and I wish it well.
Michael, what did you think?
I had very similar feelings to Peter. I thought the show really took a while to get started because not only was the elimination of that film a mistake, I think, and the audience, well, the crowd's reaction to the news of the death, but then also it seemed like there was a lot of time in the first 10 minutes or so when nothing was happening, really. People were just kind of standing there, holding candles or whatever, and singing, you know, Requiem Evita, but there wasn't a lot of movement or actually anything happening, and I think that kind of put a damper on the show. But then it really, you know, once it got going, it really got going, and I absolutely agree. It can be so hard for a director to direct a show like this in a case where the original direction is so iconic and so famous to so many people, and to do it differently, but to come up with alternatives that are equally effective in their own way. And I really think that's what he did. I was really caught up in it, and I think that the one negative thing I would say about the direction is I thought there was a little bit of a surfeit of humor in this production. There are sections that I mean, there isn't much humor in Evita to begin with, but there is some, and I think it needs to be highlighted a bit. For example, Max von Essen I'm a terrific fan of him, and he sang the role of Magaldi beautifully.
Beautifully, yep. Yeah.
But in the original and in the movie, to a certain extent, Magaldi is sort of seen as an object of fun, in that he's supposed to be kind of smarmy and not especially talented. That didn't come across at all here. I thought that there was humor lost there. Also, the humor in the section that Peter mentioned, the good night and thank you, was not as funny. The revolving door aspect of it was played down a little bit. So I did miss some of that, but honestly, it didn't really make that much difference in the final analysis. I thought it was very well directed. I'm surprised to hear that about that theory about Elena Roger. I don't know. It would be interesting to find that out. I mean, if she maybe perhaps initially she learned the role phonetically, but of course she did it for quite some time in London and now here. So, presumably her English, whatever state it was at when she started, has improved greatly. I thought her acting was superb. I was sitting quite close, but I have to say she had a lot of nuances and a lot of just like very like subtle changes in expression and body language that really, really impressed me tremendously. And I thought the fact that she was so tiny actually added to the role, in the sense that Evita is, in many respects a despicable person, but somehow the fact that she came across as a little girl, even when, at the height of her fame, that kind of, I think that sort of made her more sympathetic, more easy to relate to. I 100% agree about Ricky Martin, and I was going to make the exact same point about his gestures.
No kidding.
Wow. I know. It's interesting. I thought to myself, it seems like maybe he's a lefty, because for a lot of the show, he has his right hand in his pocket, and he is gesturing with only his left hand and making the same gesture over and over again. It's kind of like a reaching out and kind of bringing his fingers together. I can't quite explain it. It's like something you would do if you're trying to make a point about something. It almost looks like also like a stereotypically Italian gesture, for whatever that's worth. And after a while, he did it so much that I it was really distracting to me. I was surprised that the director, presumably, didn't work with him more on that. But, maybe he did. I mean, I don't know. And maybe he just wasn't able to do it. Maybe the hand in the pocket thing was the way of dealing with his discomfort. His acting, it's interesting. I thought he improved noticeably during the course of the show. In the beginning, I thought he gave a total misreading of the opening part. It's supposed to be sarcastic, but in a very kind of a negative way, where Che is singing, "Oh, what a circus and what a show." He's criticizing all, this outpouring of emotion for this woman who was, basically a dictator's wife and did a lot of horrible things for the country. But Ricky Martin sang it with this kind of smirk on his face, and it really, really seemed tremendously inappropriate. But especially in the second act, I thought he got much better. Although he never showed outright rage in the way that Mandy Patinkin and Antonio Banderas did so well in the original production and the film. But he did become much more, he seemed much more invested and much more concerned. I thought High Flying Adored was a highlight. That's such a beautiful song. And sorry, I have Ninth Avenue going on and back. Okay, there they go. Sorry about that. Maybe they're going to the funeral. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I would say it's a very creditable, it's not his Broadway debut, as many people know. He was in Les Miserables many years ago as a youth. But his first, major role as in a, as an adult and after achieving stardom. So I very creditable, I would say. I do just wish that he and or the director had worked more on the gestures and the acting. And I but I enjoy the production very much overall. There are a couple of moments to me where the singing of Elena Rogers is really not up to snuff. To me, it's interesting, Peter. A New Argentina did not bother me that much, but where I really was disappointed was there's that incredible section in the middle of Buenos Aires where mm-hmm. she sings. It's supposed to be a high belt, and where if ever I go too far, mm-hmm. she could not do it in her belt register. She had to sing it in her soprano.
That.
But the thing is, and singing in soprano wouldn't be that bad, except that it's. When you sing it in a soprano register, it's very low, and so you can't get any power out of mm-hmm. it. So that was I don't know why they didn't transpose that section. I guess they thought it would be too jarring. So that I really and honestly, she even did the number on Good Morning America this week. If some of our listeners may have seen it, and she sounds so awful in that particular one particular section that I was surprised that somebody didn't come up with a better solution to that, because she really is an amazing performer. It's not the most beautiful voice in the world, but it's very expressive and very dramatic. And I think she I certainly understand why she's been praised by so many people for the role, even as I understand why others are really unhappy because she does not sing it in the same way as Patti LuPone, and she does have those problems in particular areas. But bravo to her anyway. It's what an incredibly difficult role. It's just mind-boggling, really.
It's interesting to me the point that you talked about how Elena seems very girlish compared to Patty, who seemed tall, as Peter said. I agree with you, but that they infer in the writing of the show that with the mistress scene that Perón had a long string of very young girls, and maybe Eva Perón is just his final. What he ended up with was very similar than what he's been doing all along. What do you think about that?
Well, that definitely came across here. And if you've read anything about Perón, it was actually got to the point where it was quite disgusting, especially later in life, I believe. They were underage. quite a reprehensible character, apparently. But yes, that definitely came across. And we should add that, at least at the performance I saw, that the mistress's song, Another Suitcase in Another Hall, which very happily has been restored to the mistress, having been appropriated by Madonna for the movie of version of Evita, which I thought was a huge mistake, even though I know why they did it. Yeah, I think that it's very important to have the mistress as as the character who sings that song, and it was sung beautifully by Rachel Potter in this production, and it got a huge hand when I went. I don't know about when you saw it, Peter.
Yeah, indeed, it did. I want to point out too that for better or worse, and I liked it. I'll understand if some people don't, but I liked it. Even though Evita comes in that scene and says hello and goodbye, I've just unemployed you, etc., and she's very caustic. At the very end of when the girl is just about to leave.
Oh yes, yeah.
She gave her a very sympathetic look. Did you see that?
I did. I absolutely, and that's what I mean about Elena Rogers. She has nuances like that I don't think we've ever seen before.
That she gave really implied
you're one of me. Yeah.
Yep. I've been in your position. Yeah. I know what this is like. In a way, I feel I've got to look out for number one first. But for the record, I do feel bad for you too. So, and I like that very much. You noticed that as well. Good. It wasn't my imagination.
No, right. I think it was a very thoughtful production in that respect. I was very impressed by it, because a lot of revivals tend to just coarsen the material.
Right.
So, but this, I think, is actually, if anything, the opposite. You know, it's not as, you know, it's not as big. It's not as large. It's not as in your face as the other one. The you know, the famous original Prince production, sure. which I love. Don't get me wrong.
It's just, you know, I mean, sometimes you go to a restaurant, you feel like steak, and sometimes you feel like fish, and they're both delicious. So I mean, so I'm, but if we are to have revivals, I hope that they're of this quality and this much imagination, as opposed to let's just throw up what we had before.
And also, let me say, I have not been a huge fan of Rob Ashford in his role as director and choreographer of shows, but I think his choreography of this show, and I don't know if we've actually mentioned, the director is Michael Grandage, but Rob Ashford did the choreography, and it, I think it's exceptionally wonderful. So I, you know, I mean, my personal opinion would be that maybe he should focus more on that in the future.
I am probably going to see Evita in about 2 weeks from now. I haven't seen it yet, but one of the things that I am going for is I really love Michael Cerveris, and I think that Michael Cerveris is a huge, unrecognized great of our theater. And I was just listening to some of the Tommy recording yesterday and some of the other stuff that he's done. He's so versatile.
Yes,
and
indeed.
And so across the board, I hope that he's recognized this season, because his work, I haven't seen Evita yet, but his work in the past has been outstanding, and I suspect that his work here is just about the same. I don't know if Perrone is
that type of role. Yeah, but what's nice is he's at least been appreciated to the point where he's billed above the title, and that's a big step forward, I would say.
And Bob Gunton, if I'm correct, did win a Tony for the original production. So I'm pretty sure.
That doesn't sound right to me, but you may be right.
Well, I know he was nominated.
Because, okay, I won't disagree with that.
Yeah, I should have looked it up.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, but, so go ahead, Michael. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, yeah. Michael is tremendously versatile and also vocally versatile. It's hard to believe. In as Perrone, he uses a very, I would say, legit baritonal sound, almost like he makes you think he really could sing opera. You know, which I that never really occurred to me before. Even when he did Sweeney Todd, it didn't create quite that impression. And he, as an actor too, he's tremendously versatile. And I think it was great to have a real Broadway vet in there. I think it was very, very wise of them to cast him.
Yeah, Bob Gunton did win in 1980 for the Drama Desk Outstanding Featured Actor in a Musical. Uh-huh. He was nominated for the Tony for the best featured actor in a musical.
Nice that he won the Drama Desk. That's
yeah.
Good.
Who won the Tony?
I don't know.
Oh, right. It's funny. I had that in my mind, but you know how it is.
So anyway, I'm going to take a little break here, and maybe, Michael, you can look it up while I remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to broaderradio.com. And at Broader Radio, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you so that you can not miss anything. You can listen to us in other ways other than iTunes. You can get the Stitcher app, Stitcher. Which is for your iPhone, your iPod, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and that way you could stream us without syncing with your computer as well and not missing any episodes. You could also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World Radio plays us 3 times during the week, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you want to get in touch with us, if you agree, disagree with us for all the stuff that we've talked about, please go to broaderradio.com, and there's a contact information for Peter, Michael, and myself. You can call, leave a voicemail if you'd like. We might play it on the podcast. Also, while you're at Broadway Radio, please, please take the Broadway Radio survey, which is at the top of the page, which will help us understand who is listening to this podcast better. And you can also check out the back episodes that we've had. We've had more than 150 back episodes, which is, you know, I think about that. I'm like, wow, can't believe 150 already or so. It's at least, you know, 600 or 700 hours worth of work that we've, the three of us have done, and various other folks who have contributed in the past. So check it out. It's a lot of stuff that is on BroadwayRadio.com.
Okay, so the winner, Bob Gungeon was nominated in the featured category, and the winner was Mandy Patinkin.
Oh, sure. They were in the same category?
Sure. Yep. Hence my confusion. And the best actor winner that year was Jim Dale for Barnum.
That's strange.
Isn't it interesting? That's why I was confused. Yeah. Uh-oh. Well, you know, I mean, I guess, but it is interesting. I mean, Che is a tremendous role. And
hardly leaves stage.
Yeah, there's really no rational way you could ever consider it. Well, featured, except for, you know, well,
the Tony Awards are consistently inconsistent, so it's very confusing. You know, it's like Boston weather. Let's wait 15 minutes, it'll change. So, alrighty. We have a few other things to quickly talk about. Michael went to Carnegie Hall to see the McAdoo. Michael, you have to tell us about that.
The McAdoo.
I tried to play that. It didn't work. As my good friend Lester Malizia would say, we tried something new. It didn't work. And I did actually Evita with Lester, so it all ties together. So,
I just wanted to mention it briefly because it was transcendent. The Collegiate Chorale singing and presenting the Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado with a full orchestra conducted by Ted Sperling, the great Ted Sperling, and a cast including Chuck Cooper, Jason Danieli, Christopher Fitzgerald, Jonathan Freeman, Steve Rosen, Kelly O'Hara, Lauren Worsham, Amy Justman, and Victoria Clark. And also just, you know, musically and comedically brilliant. They had, I'm actually not that familiar with the piece, but there's a song called, I'm not sure if it's actually called I Have a Little List. Mm-hmm. And they got Joe Keenan to write new lyrics for it, who is one of the funniest writers on the face of the earth. He's one of the creators and writers of Frasier, and he's also written a few comic novels that you have got to read. They are so hilarious. And he did a brilliant. They're just.
I humiliated myself on the subway once.
Yes, I remember you mentioned that.
Is that right? Oh, okay.
Yes. I can't tell you how funny these novels are, but Peter, well, is giving an indication. It was a great night. Another great night at Carnegie Hall. It was so well directed for a concert production. I think, let's see here. Ted Sperling was listed as conductor and director. And then Andrew Palermo as associate director and choreographer. But I think I've never heard more laughs in Carnegie Hall in my life. It's hard to do comedy in a 2,700 seat theater in a concert presentation of a show. But it was just wonderful. The audience was in the palm of their hands, and I'm so glad I went. It was really an amazing night.
Michael, you also had another great experience at the Big Meal. Why don't you quickly? Peter talked about it a few weeks ago, but you just saw it.
Yes, I will just say it has been extended. I think through the end of the month, if you can get there in any way. It's a beautiful, beautiful play by Dan LaFranc about basically the generations. Three or four generations in a family, from starting where the original two people meet in a restaurant, and they kind of connect and then have their first date that starts with both of them saying, "I absolutely do not want a relationship." And it goes from that to them getting married and having children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And it's done so, so interestingly and so beautifully. There are these lightning changes, like flash forwards of like months and years, where the two people will be talking and then suddenly, you know, it's a year later or whatever, and they're about to, they're engaged and they're about to get married. And that goes on throughout the show. And then also the characters, as the characters age, the actors start to play the younger people. So the people who start out playing the initial couple then end up playing their children, and so on. And Anita Gillette is, as Peter I think mentioned, is just heartbreaking in it as the kind of center of it. And there's an effect in it that I wish I could explain. I wish I could tell you, but I cannot because it would spoil everything. But there is an absolutely heartbreaking and stunning coup de théâtre that happens about four or five times during the play to show the passage of time. I really can't even say anymore. But Dan LaFranc, oh, remember that name. Just beautiful, beautiful writing. The kind of thing that, you know, we just rarely see on Broadway anymore. And whether it should be there or not, I guess is a moot point, but it's off Broadway. So please go see it. It's at Playwrights Horizons in the not in the main theater, in the upstairs black box, not really black box, but the much smaller theater. Check it out if you can, if there's any way you can see it.
Yeah, it, as you said, it's at the Peter J. Sharp Theater at Playwrights.
One of them.
At Playwrights Horizons on 42nd Street between 9th and 10th Avenues. And it's now through April 29th, as Michael mentioned, it was extended. All righty. Peter got to see I Do, and the last 5 years. Which he wanted to talk about.
This was in Jersey. I went to see I Do, a 1966 musical at the Bickford Theater in Morris Township. It's a two-character show, man and woman, about their marriage. The next night, I was at Crossroads Theater Company in New Brunswick seeing The Last 5 Years, which is a two-character musical about a man and woman who get married as well. And what a fascinating thing to be able to see those two in successive nights, to see how much has changed and how much has stayed the same. Because the original musical, I Do, while it was produced in 66, was actually a show that dealt with a 50-year marriage starting right at the turn of the century, like 1900 going up to 1950, because it was based on a play called The Four-Poster, which was first produced in 1951. So it's basically that frame of time. And you know, that was the time when people got married and they stayed married. And here's Jason Robert Brown's musical, The Last 5 Years, which was written more than four decades later, and deals with a marriage that does not stay together. And one of the reasons is the fact that there is a bit of professional jealousy that's going on with the wife there, because her husband's career is skyrocketing while hers isn't going anywhere at all. There are two phone calls that are very important in the show, one where the young man calls hoping to land an agent and finds that he is very much welcomed after the agent reads what he's written, while the woman makes a phone call trying to get her agent to pay attention to her at all, and he's not doing it whatsoever. So even getting him on the phone was a struggle. Well, the boy's agent can't wait to talk to him. In I Do, what's interesting is that the wife is a stay-at-home mom, which has been the news a lot this week, hasn't it? And so there isn't that type of professional job. She has her job and he has his, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. Also, of course, there is a different structure for The Last 5 Years. Which is a terribly confusing one. And I was very glad that Marshall Jones, who runs Crossroads, came out and said, listen, people, his story goes in one direction while her story goes in the other direction, you know, and he let them know that. And I think that's really important. I saw a production of the same show only a couple of months ago where that wasn't made clear. George Street in New Jersey did a production a few years ago where they projected the years on the psych behind, and that's the way to do it. The original production, I don't believe, did that. I don't remember it happening. And I really think it's too much to expect people to say, I get it. She's telling her story from her. And no, that's too much. So, but just seeing the way the world has changed and the idea of marriage, and because I Do essentially says it'll all work out. Well, the last 5 years says, well, not necessarily. So that was a nice couple of evenings. Both, by the way, very well done.
Great. All righty. We're going to wrap it up with just a few little notes of news that have gone by this week. The Lion King surpassed Phantom of the Opera in all-time box office, which I thought would never happen. It was interesting to me and how it's happened. I still have to put together these numbers to see how it actually happened. Can you imagine?
Well, it happened because, of course, the Lion King was charging more. Phantom had those years when... I think Phantom top price when it started was probably $50. Seriously. I know that when I was doing research for a book, Les Mis, which only opened a year before, the top price was $47.50. I remember that vividly, and I was shocked to see it. So Phantom was probably $50.
Probably think it has to do with the touring companies, not really the...
Well, Phantom toured a lot, too.
I think that Lion King is all over the world, and I think that Phantom is all over the world, but the Phantom productions aren't playing as much as the Lion King productions all over the world are these days, and the Phantom productions kind of ran their course. I mean, there used to be three national tours in the U.S. plus a bunch of sit-down productions in San Francisco, Los Angeles, things like that... they don't have, you know, I think Phantom is just a single tour right now, and I don't think there's any sit-down productions. I'm not positive about that.
Yeah, but honestly, I mean, I'm sorry. It is kind of a spurious record. The only real thing that really counts is, number of paid admissions.
Yeah.
Because to adjust for inflation is you know, it's kind of difficult to do that and get an accurate.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, admissions, you're right, Michael. And as I understand, 4 million more people have seen Phantom than Lion King.
Yes.
And, of course, the reason, too, is that it had such a head start, a 10-year head start. So congratulations to both.
I laugh at the our friends in the Hollywood industry who look down their noses at Broadway, and all I have to say to them is, what's your all-time most grossing feature? And they say, oh, Titanic. And I said, well, at this point, Phantom was three times more grossing than Titanic was. So I think Titanic grossed $1 billion and Phantom was about $3 billion at that point. So all I can say is it's nice to be, the left coast little brother to Broadway. So we joked a few weeks ago about Carrie getting a recording, and that we were talking about the New York Public Library archive recording, but it seems like Ghostlight is going to make a recording of Carrie, so we actually will get a real recording of it.
Good. Good luck to it. I'm sure there are people who want it.
Oh, don't tell me that you won't have a copy of it, Peter, just to make it complete,
James has been to my apartment. He knows that it's covered. really, I don't know where I've got to move. I just have to. I mean, I need more space for the CDs. It's not for me. I'm fine, but the CDs need more space.
I was disappointed but not surprised to see, I believe in a New York Times article, at least one of the authors, again, blaming the failure of this version, not on the quality of the material, but on the critics.
I
guess they're just never ever going to accept the fact that a lot of people think they didn't quite do it.
They can try again. I understand that they're licensing it out and they're going to have other productions, so we'll see if the critics elsewhere will enjoy it or not. So what's coming up on the agenda for you guys? You guys, what are you seeing this week coming up so we can talk about next week?
I'm really looking forward to One Man, Two Governors, because so many people have loved it so much. So I'm really up for that. I'm looking forward to revisiting Peter and the Starcatcher. That's happening this week.
I'm going to get to see Judith of Bethulia, so I can report on that because I know it's a very hot ticket. Peter, have you gone or are you going?
No, I didn't get an invitation to.
I had to ask.
Huh? Yeah, so.
Yeah, Charles Bush off Broadway at Theater for the New City, I believe. I hear it's beyond hilarious, and I also do hear that about One Man, Two Governors. Somebody who went said it was the funniest show he'd ever seen in his life.
How wonderful!
Yeah.
All righty. There's the British government subsidizing our Broadway tastes again. Mm-hmm. They will say. Alrighty, so, we look forward to seeing everybody back next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. So until then, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. My moon and my stars.